book called Dexter Proctor, the 10-year-old doctor. It is, of course, writer, comedian, former doctor, Adam Kay. See you then.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News, I'm Alison Hughes. President Biden says a regional conflict in the Middle East has to be avoided, as Israeli airstrikes have killed nearly 50 people in Lebanon today and hit targets in Gaza and Yemen. Lebanon's Prime Minister says a million people may have been forced from their homes by the bombardment aimed at the armed group Hezbollah. Dr. Shoki Amin Edin from the International Committee for the Red Cross in Lebanon says the country has been plunged into chaos.
People are suffering from displacement, from economic hardships, as well as struggling to find shelters, to find access to water, to food, and even to essential healthcare that they might need. And sometimes they don't have enough time to gather basic belongings and essential items that they need, which makes, again, the displacement even more concerning for us.
In Yemen, Israeli warplanes have hit the city of Hodeidah. A military statement says the attacks targeted power plants and a seaport. Israel says the facilities were being used by the Houthis to transfer weapons and oil from Iran. A man in his 60s has been arrested on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter after an 8-year-old boy died of gunshot wounds in Cumbria. Emergency services were called to a farm in the Walkup area yesterday afternoon. The child died of his injuries overnight. The former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has urged Conservative Party members at their conference in Birmingham to end the squabbling and back whoever replaces him as leader. The four remaining candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly, will be reduced to two by MPs on the 9th and 10th of October. The party membership will then choose the winner. Mr Sunak made a plea for unity.
We must end the division, the backbiting, the squabbling. We mustn't nurse old grudges but build new friendships. We must always remember what unites us rather than obsessing about where we might differ. Because when we turn in on ourselves, we lose, and the country ends up with a Labour government.
A former Russian spy and his daughter, who were poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok in Salisbury in 2018, will not have to appear to give evidence to a public inquiry. The judge overseeing the hearings said there was an overwhelming risk of an attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal. And the far-right Freedom Party is projected to have won Austria's general election, but fallen well short of an outright majority. Forming a coalition is likely to be complicated, as other parties have said they won't go into government with the Freedom Party's leader, Herbert Kickl.
Europe's elite club competition.
The Champions League.
Right here on BBC Radio 5 Live. On Tuesday at 8.
Arsenal host PSG.
Right footed. This is saved by Raya. A fantastic goal save.
And on Wednesday at 8.
Aston Villa take on Bayern Munich.
Tielemans waiting. Control. Driven shot. Bottom corner.
And watch highlights of every single match with Match of the Day Wednesday night on BBC iPlayer.
The Champions League
on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good evening, welcome along. The Conservative Party conference is starting in Birmingham with the four people vying to be leader taking part in hustings this evening. But one of the contenders has caused a storm, suggesting maternity pay has gone too far and the government needs to interfere less in people's lives.
We need to allow businesses, especially small businesses, to make more of their own decisions. The exact amount of maternity pay, in my view, is neither here nor there. We need to make sure that we are creating an environment where people can work and people can have more freedom. We need to have more personal responsibility.
That's prospective Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch. Are you a mum or a dad? A small business has had problems with maternity provision? We're looking for you to call us tonight. Also this evening, Israeli attacks continue in Lebanon.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Those are explosions of what the IDF say are Iran-backed Houthi military targets in Yemen. We'll get the latest tonight. And there are also calls this evening for an investigation after the death of a West Bromwich Albion fan at Sheffield Wednesday yesterday.
There was a chance to stop the game. That's how clearly we knew there was a huge issue, and it was clearly based around somebody having a heart attack. It was very easy to establish that. There's a question mark as to why the game wasn't stopped. I know the game was on television, and whether that's got anything to do with it or not, who knows, but there seemed to be a distinct determination not to stop the game.
We'll look at that and speak to fans later. Have you been on a plane and felt your blood pressure rise as the person front dares to recline their seat? We'll talk about flight etiquette on the show this evening. We're all about your calls. Here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms
for our terms of use and privacy notice.
Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good evening. Fighting continues on multiple fronts in the Middle East today after Israeli attacks and the assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut on Friday night. Israel says it has carried out large-scale airstrikes on Yemen today. It says it has attacked military targets and the Iran-backed Houthis' port and energy facilities. Let's get the latest. Our Middle East correspondent John Donaldson is in Jerusalem this evening. Tell us about these latest attacks, John.
Well, let's start in Yemen, and this is really a reminder that Israel is now fighting on several fronts, and it adds to the fear, I think, that this could escalate into a wider regional war. So what Israel said it did today was it targeted one of Yemen's biggest ports used to import oil. Two power stations were hit. The images of those strikes saw massive explosions, the port engulfed in flames. And Israel says it carried out these strikes in response to missile attacks and drone attacks carried out by the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen. This is not the first time that the Houthis have done this. They fiercely oppose Israel's actions in Gaza and in Lebanon, and they say they will continue attacking Israel until Israel's aggression, as they put it, stops in Gaza and Lebanon.
So this does start to give you a sense of the fear from some of how this war can escalate, and escalate quickly and widen.
Yes, and that has been the fear ever since the war erupted in Gaza almost a year ago, that it could spread into a much more dangerous, wider regional conflict. So we've now got, in effect, a war being fought in Gaza, in Lebanon against Hezbollah, and the possibility of other players in the region getting more significantly involved, notably Iran. Everyone is waiting to see how Iran might respond to the assassination of the Hezbollah leader, who, of course, Hezbollah was founded by Iran, is funded by Iran, gets all its weapons from Iran, and Iran has said it will seek vengeance for that assassination, and it's not done so yet. But the fear is that Iran could get directly involved, and of course it is a very powerful force in the Middle East.
How powerful are the Houthis?
Well, they have long-range missiles capable of reaching Israel. Every time they have tried to fire them, or certainly most times, those have been shot down or intercepted over the Red Sea. They get, again, a lot of their funding and support from Iran. You'll know that they fought a long war with the Saudi-backed regime in Yemen, but it's the Houthis who are now effectively in power. And what they've got in their favour is that they, in effect, can control access to the Red Sea shipping lane. And you'll remember that late last year and into the new year this year, we saw Houthi rebels seizing ships, including some British-owned ships, and trying to stop the supply of materials heading towards Israel.
And the Americans are trying to de-escalate as much as they can. Have they any more influence over the Houthis as they are over anybody else?
No, and I think the truth is that, you know, America has been pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza for months. It's been pushing for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, certainly over the last few weeks. And it's really a symbol of America's impotence at the moment in terms of limiting Israel's actions. Israel feels that it will do everything it needs to protect its citizens. It wants 60,000 Israelis who've been displaced because of the fighting on the northern border with Lebanon over the past year. It has pledged to return them to their homes. And until it defeats Hezbollah, or certainly causes them to stop firing into northern Israel, then those citizens are not going to be able to do so.
And finally, John, what are we looking out for over the coming hours and days? What are we looking out for next week as a predictor of where this might go next?
Well, there are two things we're looking out for. One is the possibility of a ground invasion into Lebanon to deal with Hezbollah. Israeli troops have been massing on the border over the past few weeks, and most analysts feel that in order to defeat Hezbollah and to dismantle their military capabilities in Lebanon, it's going to take more than airstrikes, and it would require a ground operation that would bring with it a lot more risk. You'll know that in 2006, when there was the last full-scale war between Hezbollah and Israel, Israel went into Lebanon, it invaded, but it was eventually pushed back and it lost quite a lot of soldiers in that. So that's one thing we're looking for. The second thing is, what is Iran going to do? Because so far Israel has calculated, rightly I think, that Iran does not want to get directly involved in a military confrontation with Israel. Well, what's happened to Hassan Nasrallah and the possibility of a ground invasion, well, that could see that calculation change. And if Iran were to get directly involved, that bring things to a whole new dangerous level.
Okay, John Donaldson in Jerusalem for us tonight. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Now, next, the Tory leadership candidate, Kemi Badenoch, says maternity pay has gone too far and the government needs to interfere less in people's lives. The Shadow Business Secretary was speaking to Times Radio.
Maternity pay varies depending on who you work for, but it is a function, where it's statutory maternity pay, it is a function of tax. Tax comes from people who are working. We're taking from one group of people and giving to another. This, in my view, is excessive. Businesses are closing. Businesses are not starting in the UK because they say that the burden of regulation is too high.
So maternity pay is excessive.
I think it's gone too far the other way in terms of general business regulation. We need to allow businesses, especially small businesses, to make more of their own decisions. The exact amount of maternity pay, in my view, is neither here nor there. We need to make sure that we are creating an environment where people can work and people can have more freedom to make their individual decisions.
Well, it's here nor there for people who can't afford to have a baby, isn't it?
We need to have more personal responsibility.
Well, after that interview, Badenoch said the burden of regulation on business has gone too far. Of course, I believe in maternity pay. But the statement from Kemi Badenoch that the actual amount of it is neither here nor there, is that how it feels to you if you're relying on it? 0808 590 693, if you want to talk about all of this. Statutory maternity pay starts at 90% of average weekly earnings for 6 weeks. It then falls to the lowest of either £184 or 90% of the mother's average salary for 33 weeks. Of that amount, the government will pay 92% of statutory maternity pay, or 103% if the business qualifies for small employers relief. According to Lord Michael Ashcroft's biography of Badenoch, she resigned instead of taking maternity leave from The Spectator. Rian Bynon speaks for Maternity Action, a maternity rights charity. Rian, good evening.
Hello there.
What do you make of what Kemi Badenoch has said?
Well, I think that there's just a lack of understanding there, really, about, you know, what maternity pay is there for. It's there to support women to in a period when they can't work and they need to recover from the birth of a child. And then, you know, it's there for parents to be able to, you know, bond with a new baby, which we know is incredibly important for child development. But, you know, relative to the national minimum wage, such a maternity pay, it's worth less than half of the national minimum wage for a week now, less than a third of average earnings. And, you know, lots of families, when they start having children, they find that their family income takes, you know, a tremendous impact from having a child. And there are a whole generation of mothers out there who are very unhappy about the fact that they're having to take on debt and cut short their maternity leave when they have children, because they're caught between this hard place of, you know, quite poor rate of statutory maternity pay and also cost of living pressures. So there are a whole generation of women out there who are just not getting time with the babies in the way that they should do, not getting the time to recover. And the system really needs reviewing. We need to look at how we're funding maternity pay, but crucially, you know, for families in the cost of living crisis, look at the level to which it's funded as well.
Do you think Badenoch can come back from this? The actual amount is neither here nor there. She's running to be the leader of the Conservative Party.
I mean, it suggests that she is somewhat out of touch with the needs of families. Having said that, you know, we've got a Labour government that is proposing new employment rights, but actually hasn't said anything either about the rates of maternity pay. The only political party we heard talking about it before the election were the Liberal Democrats. And I suppose we would be calling on all the parties, but particularly the government, to think about how they can reform and improve maternity pay over the term of this government. Certainly, you know, under the Conservative government, we did see a period when there was a break between the rate of inflation and maternity pay and other benefits. So the maternity pay lost value relative to what we would we can see in the national minimum wage. So that situation really, really needs redressing. There are a whole generation of women starting families who are, you know, having to go to food banks to get through pregnancy and maternity leave, and having to borrow from friends and families. It's quite common for people to save to get through the maternity leave and still to end up several thousand pounds in debt after maternity leave, and that's before you start paying for childcare. And, you know, we were shocked in our survey to find that, you know, a fifth of the fathers or co-parents couldn't afford to spend any time with the mother after the birth of the baby. So clearly the system is not working, and it really needs urgently reviewing.
Thank you for talking to us, Rhea. Nicola Smith is Head of Rights International Social Economics Department at the Trade Unions Congress. Hello to you, Nicola.
Good evening.
Good evening. Jonathan Cribb from the Independent Economic Research Group, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Hello, Jonathan.
Good evening.
Good evening. And we're looking to hear from you tonight, 0808 509 693. So it's neither here nor there, Nicola, how much people get for maternity pay, according to Kemi Badenoch.
We've just heard today how out of touch the Tory party still are with real working families' lives and the realities of what life is like, both for people across the country after 14 years of falling living standards, and also for those families who are at home at the moment with a new baby, trying to think about how they can get through the next few weeks on statutory maternity pay. £184 a week is very far from neither here nor there. It's a very low amount of money to survive on when you are out of work, but it's an absolutely essential benefit to enable women to stay connected to the jobs market when they have babies, like we've just heard, to help people recover from giving birth and to help them spend time as they build a new family together with their newborn. So it's an essential part of modern labour market regulation. Yes, the amount needs to be increased, and I'm sure that in time that's something this country will want to continue to do. But the fact we've got a Conservative Party candidate even considering the idea that we should be going backwards on what's now an absolutely essential part of every modern economy that has working women in it, it just shows how completely beyond the pale they are.
Do you agree, Jonathan?
I don't really have a view on what the on what Kemi Badenoch said. I think that a lot of this discussion sometimes is a bit can be a bit confused, because maternity pay, statutory maternity pay at least, as you said at the top of the programme, is mostly covered by the government, rather than being a kind of burden on business, at least directly. And many businesses will choose to offer more than, not every business, but many businesses would choose to offer more than the kind of minimum. And that is at the cost of the business. But that is like the offer of holiday or, you know, additional holiday or pension contributions in excess of the minimum, or indeed, you know, how much you get paid in your salary, a function of what the government, what businesses think is the right offer to their employees to attract them and motivate them and retain them. So, you know, I think that it's discussing about exactly how much the burden of business for maternity pay per se is not really the right question, to be honest.
So what is the right question?
Well, I think there is a legitimate question from any political party or any politician about to what extent should the government be writing regulations on which different types of kind of workplace benefits should businesses have to provide. And there's an equally a discussion about to what extent should government be providing the benefits like statutory maternity pay. You know, different people are going to have different views on the appropriate role of government in regulating businesses there and how much they should offer.
But what is your view on that?
I have no, it's not my job to have a view. My job is to kind of set out how these systems work and what the potential trade-offs could be of changing some of these things.
Nicola, you've got a view and a very strong view as to what business should be doing. But the point is, will they really lose that many employees if they don't pay beyond the bare minimum?
Working families across the UK are facing all sorts of really substantial problems at the moment. We know that when mums and dads start a family, there's real challenges making sure that both of them are able to take time off and spend time with their kids in those early days. We know that it's really difficult for people to find the sorts of jobs that give them security, but also give them the ability to balance their work with childcare. We know that access to decent childcare is a real challenge for many working families across the country. And, you know, these are all problems that it is right for government to think about and to work with workers and with employers to think about how they can be solved. That's why we're really supportive of what the Labour government is now doing with its agenda to make work pay and the really important proposals that it's brought forward to introduce, you know, for example, day one rights to parental leave to make it easier for mums and dads in those early days, to make it harder for people just to sack pregnant women for no reason other than the fact that they're about to have a baby, to introduce new rights to make it easier for people to work more flexibly in more sorts of different roles. You know, modern economies have got a balance of labour market regulation that sets a minimum floor that everyone has to abide by, and then employers that can afford to go above it, they do that. But, you know, we've seen decades of progress in this UK, in this area. We've seen the minimum wage introduced, and when that happened, we heard huge scare stories about millions of jobs were going to be lost, no one could afford it. Lo and behold, the minimum wage has gone up consistently under Labour governments, under Tory governments. Not a single jobs haven't been lost, employment's remained high, and we've seen all sorts of wider benefits for people as well. This is an area where, you know, we've now got a really important opportunity under this government to think about what more can be done with workers and with employers to make more jobs work better for working families, so that new families get the best start in life and that mums and dads get the sorts of jobs that they need to work around their childcare needs. That is the discussion we should be having, not some frankly ridiculous conversation about going back 50 years and removing maternity rights from women, which is the last thing anyone should be focused on at the moment.
Nicola and Jonathan, thank you. 0858 909 693. So, as you've been hearing tonight, the Conservative Party conference has got underway in Birmingham today, the first since the party's heavy general election defeat, and the rarest of beasts has been seen, a party leader.
There is a brilliant buzz at this conference, isn't there? It's fantastic. Terrific energy. Thousands of you here. We've got members, councillors, MPs, businesses. In fact, it's such a hot ticket, I'm surprised that Keir Starmer hasn't asked somebody to buy him one. Now, I want to start by saying thank you. Thank you for everything that you do for our party and the support that you've always given Ushtar and me. You all worked tirelessly during the election campaign, and I'm only sorry that I could not deliver the result that your efforts deserved.
The former Prime Minister and still the party leader, Rishi Sunak, he's urging members to end the squabbling and back whoever is elected as the leader to replace him. All four candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, James Cleverly, Tom Tugendhat, have taken part in hustings tonight. Let's get the rundown from Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Reem, you were at the conference. Is there a brilliant buzz like Rishi Sunak has suggested?
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for having me on. And honestly, yes, it's really quite incredible. So it's interesting because obviously the Conservative Party leadership election is really the highlight of the conference. I remember when the election was called earlier this year, the general election, I thought that Conservative Party conference this year would be, you know, much more dull, that it would feel as though, you know, there is this huge amount of weight on the party for sort of receiving such a huge, incredible defeat at the election. But actually, what there is here, it feels as though there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of discussions about what the Conservative Party should stand for, what the ideology should look like, what the principles, what does it mean to be a Conservative? And of course, all of these debates are occurring not just on the main stage, but at fringe events. Members are discussing it, and it feels like there's hype and there's I suppose, notion of hope, but all of it comes down to what the future of the party looks like.
How can there be a notion of hope if they're having to ask what does it mean to be a Conservative? If they haven't already established that, how low have they got?
Well, very low. They lost one of the worst election defeats in recent Conservative Party history.
But that's my point. So why would there be a buzz around the place? The former Prime Minister saying there's this buzz, there's this energy. They're losers.
They did lose. That's absolutely right. But there is a new direction. There is this hope for a new change.
There isn't a new direction. I mean, they don't even have a leader. The man still doing the speech is the former Prime Minister who lost. There is no new direction because there's no new leader yet.
You're absolutely right. There is no leader yet. And that's the whole point. That's why there is this buzz. That's why there is this hope. And from my perspective, I obviously come from the IEA, which is a free market think tank. So we have no partisan views and no corporate views. But we are obviously interested in what the future direction of the right as a whole looks like. Now, from my perspective, I think the Conservative Party of the last 14 years have not been very conservative. These are very, very key questions. One of them I really want to hone in on, Stephen, is this question of housing. Now, I think that housing is the most important political issue facing this country and facing this future. I think that my generation of young people are unable to afford their own homes because the government have actively restricted house building. Now, the reason why that's happened and the reason why Conservative governments over the last 14 years have effectively refused to tackle the problem is because those young people don't vote for them. One of the key discussions that I've been having and that people have been talking to me about over the last day has effectively been that in order for the Conservative Party to actually get more of those Conservative voters, there needs to be a feeling that there is a stake in society. There needs to be a feeling that there is hope for people. This kind of harping back to what Thatcher wanted to do in 1979. So there does, I can understand from sort of outside perspective how it can feel a little bit strange. You've just lost a huge election. Why is everybody feeling so hopeful? I think they're hopeful for change. They're hopeful that the Conservative Party will ultimately be conservative again, and they're hopeful. It feels as though members around here are hopeful that that change will happen as a result of the leadership election. Now, one point I do want to make: the leadership election is much longer than previous ones we've had. If we remember, the last one was in 2022. The two final runners were Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, and the members ended up voting for Liz Truss. This year, the leadership election is much longer, and what that allows for, Stephen, is a real conversation about the principles that define the heart and soul of the Conservative Party. And those are the discussions that are happening today.
But what might those principles be that's different to what we've just had in terms of what defines the Conservative Party?
Yeah, really, really interesting question. That's effectively what the debate is. From my perspective, what I want to see a government do, or potential Conservative government do, is fix house building, and that does mean, you know, really tackling the planning system. But from a first principles basis, this means being pro-market, being pro-capitalism. Again, you know, the Conservative Party presided over the highest tax burden since the Second World War. The Conservative Party in government presided over legislation like the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, which would have effectively made smoking illegal for the next generation of young people. Now, all of these questions about liberty, does the Conservative Party really believe in freedom and free enterprise and business? Well, over the last 14 years, they've effectively crushed freedom and crushed business. You know, all of these defining principles have been lost. And honestly, it's the first time, and I've been to the last three Conservative Party conferences, and I've always felt as though there seems to be lacking these kind of concepts, the ideas, the discussion, the intellectual debate. This is probably one of the first conferences I've seen, or the first discussions I've seen, where people are actually questioning, why am I a Conservative? What is it that I actually believe? And the only reason why this is happening is because they're being forced to look into the mirror and see, why is it the British public rejected them so hard in July?
So finally, what can we expect this week coming?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. Of course, there is going to be effectively a hustings in many ways. So Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch will face member questions on the main stage, and James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick will be doing the same on Tuesday. Now, Wednesday morning, we'll see all of the candidates, all four of them, give speeches. And what that means is there is an opportunity for every single member to have those conversations and really think about what it is that they want. Now, I'm not necessarily interested in who the leader ends up being. I don't particularly like glorifying particular politicians. But what this conversation does allow is for those particular kind of restrictions on what they actually mean. Now, Tom Tugendhat has, of course, been, I suppose, pegged as a bit more of the sort of left-leaning, centre-right candidate. Kemi Badenoch has sort of come out as a little bit more hard-line on those things. Now, Robert Jenrick has today, well, sort of preemptively said that he's going to go much more hardline on things like the ECHR. So he's already come out and criticised Kemi Badenoch for not being as hardline on the ECHR. Robert is going to say that we should be leaving. So again, a lot of these discussions seem to be about policy, about what they actually stand for. And for me, that's really interesting, because it's really the first time I'm seeing those kind of discussions being taking place. I also just want to make the point, usually on the Wednesday at Conservative Party conference, it'll be the party leader that makes the final speech. This year, it is entirely different. It is not the party leader. Rishi Sunak has already made a speech. It is going to be the potential next leader of the Conservative Party. All four of them are going to be able to make their speeches and make their pitch for why they should lead the Conservative Party and ultimately lead the country.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to talk to you tonight, Reem. 0808 5909 693. Who do you think should take over? Do you think the Tory party can fundamentally change? What about Labour and where Sir Keir Starmer is already? Is it a mess that he's in over the freebies? Lots of politics to talk about tonight. 0808 5909 693. Here comes the news first from the BBC.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the headlines, I'm John Wilkinson. The US President Joe Biden has said that a regional conflict in the Middle East has to be avoided after Israeli airstrikes killed nearly 50 people in Lebanon and also hit targets in Gaza and Yemen. Lebanon's Prime Minister said a million people may have been forced from their homes by the Israeli bombardment aimed at the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. The former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has urged Conservative Party members meeting at their conference in Birmingham to end the squabbling and back whoever is elected as the leader to replace him. The four remaining candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly, will be reduced to two by MPs, with the party membership then choosing the winner. A man in his 60s, arrested after the death of an 8-year-old boy from gunshot wounds in Cumbria, has been released on bail pending further investigations. Emergency services were called to a farm in the Walkop area yesterday afternoon. The boy died of his injuries overnight. And the far-right Freedom Party is projected to have won Austria's general election, but fallen well short of an outright majority. Forming a coalition is likely to be complicated, as other parties have said they won't go into government with the Freedom Party's leader. Here's your sport. Manchester United have equalled their joint worst start in the Premier League after six games. They were beaten 3-0 at home to Tottenham this evening, with captain Bruno Fernandes getting a red card when they were 1-0 down. He has protested his innocence, though.
Never a red card, that's all my view. It's a foul. I agree that it's a foul, but never a red card because I don't think he's there. First of all, as the referee was trying to tell me that he looked at it as a clear contact with the studs. Don't touch it with the studs, don't even touch him with the foot. I touch it with my ankle, so it's a clear foul. If he wants to give me a yellow because they're going on a counter, I completely agree. More than that, I think it's not the case.
As for Spurs, Dominic Solanke scored for the third game in a row. Brennan Johnson scored for the fourth. Aston Villa missed the chance to go joint top of the league with a 2-2 draw at Ipswich. Goalscorer Ollie Watkins says they were guilty of not playing their own game.
We kind of fell into their hands, you know, a basketball game really. It was end to end and that's what they wanted. You know, they caught us on the transition a couple of times and yeah, I felt like we had a lot of opportunities if we just got the final pass right. You know, I mean, I'm included in that and we could have saw the game out after my goal.
Rangers won in the Scottish Premiership, beating Hibernian 1-0. In the Women's Super League, there were wins for Manchester City, Manchester United and Arsenal, whilst this evening's Atletico Madrid versus Real Madrid match was suspended for 20 minutes. Objects had appeared to be thrown onto the pitch. The game eventually ended 1-1. In rugby union, England's women have started the defence of their WXV1 title with a 61-21 win against the USA in Vancouver. It was watched by our reporter Sarah Orchard.
A bonus point win and job done, but the scoreline does flatter England, who faced a dogged American side who wouldn't go away, scoring three tries of their own. The positives for the Red Roses include a standout performance from Saracens fly half Zoe Harrison, who controlled well in a starting 10 shirt, and a positive debut for Bristol Bears centre Phoebe Murray. But tougher tests are ahead, with world champions New Zealand and host Canada coming up in the next fortnight.
Earlier, Bath beat Leicester Tigers by 20 points to 15 in the Premiership. In cricket, England's comeback in their one-day international series against Australia came to an end this afternoon. Ben Duckett had scored a century in England's 309, but Australia won the match by 49 runs under DLS because of the rain in Bristol. The tourists take the series 3-2, but England's interim white ball head coach Marcus Trescothick says it was fine margins.
If you look at all the games that we lost across the five games, and I think there's, you know, we had periods within all of those games where you think, right, we could have made a real impact in winning this game. So the series could have been very much different, but, you know, that's the way it goes. Winning and losing is broken down onto those small margins when you're playing games.
On the final day of the county championship season, meanwhile, Sussex took the Division 2 title. Mark Selby has just won Snooker's British Open title. And in golf, Keegan Bradley has won the decisive point for the United States to win their 10th President's Cup in a row against the international team in Montreal.
If you love your pop, this is right up your street.
Pop Top 10 with Scott and Rylan.
We've picked some of the most hotly contested questions of all time and decided to settle them once and for all with the help of some special guests. We're taking it very seriously.
I can't let things like that slide on this show.
No, come on!
What are you on about?
Don't put words into my mouth.
I won't, darling. You're spatting them yourself. Search Pop Top 10 to listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Stephen Nolan.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Thanks. Thanks very much indeed for being with me tonight. There are calls for an investigation into the death of a West Bromwich Albion fan during their game against Sheffield Wednesday yesterday. West Brom says the supporter suffered a medical emergency during the game at Hillsborough. The club says it has made contact with their family to pass on their condolences, as do we here at 5 Live. In a statement on its website, the club said the thoughts of all of us will remain with the supporters' loved ones at this desperately sad time. Claims have been made about the speed of matchday stewards and paramedics to react to the emergency and about the English Football League's policy that if treatment is required in the stands, the game should not be stopped and action on the field should continue. Ali Jones is former head of action for Albion Fans Trust. He was in the stand when this happened. He's been speaking to 5 Live's Adrian Hughes.
It was a mid part of the first half. Albion were losing, and not that that remotely matters now, but and then behind me, I was in Block V, and behind me I saw lots of waving arms and panic shouts, really, about get up here quickly, and it continued for what seemed like a considerable amount of time before any action was really took place. And the game carried on, which I was surprised about, if I'm being honest. I thought that the game should have been stopped because there was obviously clearly a distressing point for all fans and the players as well, because there was clearly an issue. But it seemed to be very confusing and sort of probably a delay that longer than anybody would be comfortable with. But obviously, there's got to be some investigation to be taken place as to what happened. So I don't really want to comment much further than that. But from where I was, with probably 12 to 15 rows in front, there seemed to take an age to get any help there, and then another even longer to get the paramedics there, and then they didn't seem to be well equipped to get the gentleman out of the stands to be attended to. And at half time, the cordoned off between, I think it was V&X, and the guy was there. It just felt like a general malaise and a delay in getting the treatment that the guy clearly needed. And obviously, I believe now that there's a defibrillator that took a long time to get there. I don't understand in 2024 why it's taken that long, if I'm being honest. That's what my initial takeaway was.
It must have been your fellow fans around you that would have been doing everything that they could have done to help him.
There was chance to stop the game. That's how clearly we knew there was issues. There was clearly a huge issue, and it was clearly based around somebody having a heart attack. It was very easy to establish that, even in a game. You know, again, there's a question mark as to why the game wasn't stopped. I believe, and I'm pretty sure this is correct, there's a defibrillator on each bench now with the club doctors there. And again, the question has to be asked as to why that protocol wasn't used. It just seemed, I know the game was on television, and whether that's got anything to do with it or not, who knows, but there seemed to be a distinct determination not to stop the game.
When you did see emergency services or people with high-vis jackets, whatever it was, coming around you, what did you actually notice? Was it stewards? Was it paramedics that came first? Could you give us an idea of that?
There wasn't any paramedics for what felt like an inordinate amount of time, but there were stewards after what seemed a long time. And look, I'm well aware that it's a very emotional state and time seems to stand still, but there seemed to be a hell of a long time from the moment the alerts bells were raised to actually help being there. It was longer than felt comfortable. I'd say over 10 minutes before the paramedics got to where the gentleman was.
And we have seen in games previously, haven't we, that the game will be stopped and perhaps even medical teams from the clubs will be running out to try to help, and that just didn't happen on this occasion.
No. No. And please don't think, at no point am I blaming anything to do with Sheffield Wednesday Football Club or West Bromwich Albion Football Club. That's not the case for what I'm trying to say at all, but I'm just saying I've been at games where games have been stopped for a medical emergency. This clearly was one, and it wasn't, and I don't understand why yesterday was different to other games that we've all been to where the game's been stopped.
The EFL have pointed us to a change in their rules, which does say don't stop the game unless it's absolutely necessary.
Says the guy passed away. I mean, I don't know how more necessary it can be than that. I mean, the guy had a heart attack and has sadly passed, and we're all, as a fan base, we're a very close-knit and united family at West Brom, and we've been through a lot together over the last couple of years, and it's made us even more united. But if the game should have been stopped for me, and I can't help but think it's because it was on the television that had a point as regards to why the game wasn't stopped. I put it like this, I tweeted yesterday that I felt that if the game wasn't on live television, it would have been stopped.
What do you think you'll be doing from here, Ali? Do you think you'll be taking it any further yourself?
Look, with regards to taking it further, we've got to give the clubs the time, and our club will be very, very good at this sort of thing with regards to communication with the fans. They'll do everything they possibly can to find out what's happened, and I trust our club implicitly to be able to carry that through, and they'll ask any questions that need doing. The most important thing is please give the family time to grieve, and please don't make it a social media inquiry. Let the inquiry do its course and give the family time and space to grieve. They've just lost a son, a brother and an uncle. And everyone associated with West Bromwich Albion, as fans, want to send our deepest condolences to all of the family. And let's see what happens. But let's have the proper channels find out what happened rather than surmising on social media channels, which won't help anybody.
That's Adrian Hughes asking the questions. Let's speak to BBC Sheffield sports editor, Rob Statton. Good evening, Rob.
Good evening, Stephen.
Good evening. What have the EFL said?
Well, I contacted the EFL today for guidance on what the policy is for what a match official should do in this kind of situation. Because I remember being at a game in April when the game was stopped and a gentleman received CPR in the ground, and the match only restarted after the person involved was taken to hospital. And thankfully, in that instance, the person survived. So they've got in touch. They sent me guidance on the general policies. And there are two at the bottom end of this guidance, which read, while the stoppage of play may sometimes seem like the appropriate action, it does raise further safety and privacy issues with regards to policing, crowd movement and media. Therefore, unless the welfare of the supporter in question is specifically affected by the continuation of the match, play should continue. So that is what the policy is. That is what the guidance is in this situation.
So presumably, the inference from all of that is that if everything stops, the focus is going to be on that one individual, thousands of people staring at him or her, and that's what they're trying to avoid.
I can only speak from my experience of that match in April, when the supporter at the New York Stadium in Rotherham had a medical emergency and the game stopped. That fan was receiving CPR in the ground, and there was a long period where the game had stopped and everybody was just sat or stood in the ground watching that unfold. And it was quite distressing. So I suspect that is partly why this policy, well, this is what this policy is saying when it talks about privacy with regarding to the crowd and the media, for example. It may well be talking about that. When I published what the EFL had passed on social media, one supporter suggested that in this kind of situation, though, if a goal had been scored while the game was going on by West Bromwich Albion, how would that have helped the situation? Which I think is perhaps a fair point that warrants some consideration. It's hard to imagine how that would have helped the medical team in this instance if the away end was reacting to a goal.
And obviously there are lots of details around this that we just don't have clarity about yet. Ali Jones suggesting that there are some people wondering why it took so long to get various medical equipment to this individual fan.
I can only speak of what I saw in the stadium at the time. It became very clear to everybody who was at Hillsborough that there was a medical emergency in the Leppings Lane end, because nearly the entire away end of West Brom fans were waving, trying to get the attention of the match officials. As we heard from the gentleman earlier, there were chants directed towards the match officials calling for the game to be stopped. And this did go on for some time. And there were at least a couple of Sheffield Wednesday players that I noticed actually go and speak to the referee, I think to check that he'd seen what the fans in the away end were saying. And it appeared the referee spoke to those players and then the game continued. We did see the medical staff going into Leppings Lane. And then we saw another person go up to the top tier of the Leppings Lane stand with a stretcher. So that happened. The supporters in the away end were signalling to the match officials to try and stop the game for some length of time, you would have to say.
There is the rule book, I get it. There's the policy which you've read to us this evening, Rob. What did it feel like, a medical emergency and a game of football at the same time?
It felt quite uncomfortable because you will see instances at football matches where fans will try and raise awareness to stewards or to the officials on the pitch when there's a medical emergency at a ground. Indeed, there was a similar situation at the game, one of the other games involving one of our local teams, Sheffield United at Portsmouth yesterday, where the attention was raised for some medical staff to enter the crowd and assist somebody. So you do see this happen, but you don't often see a whole away end, pretty much everybody waving, trying to signal to the referee. And when it goes on for a long time, it was quite unsettling to see how many fans were trying to, who felt like they, because it was going on, it was continuing, and the calls for the match to be stopped, and the continuous waving every time the ball went out of play, and not knowing what was happening in that instance, you could only feel that this was a very serious issue. And with the amount of fans who were trying to get the attention of whether it was the officials or whoever they felt they needed to get in touch with at that point, it was quite difficult to witness.
Rob, thank you. We can speak to former Five Live presenter, West Brom fan, Adrian Goldberg, who's been talking about this on his The Liquidator West Brom Fans podcast. Adrian, nice to talk to you this evening. Good evening, my friend.
Hi, Stephen. How are you doing? Good to speak to you.
It would be good to speak to you in better circumstances than this, obviously. What have fans been telling you?
Yeah, well, firstly, I've got to say, Stephen, as a West Brom fan, I'll send out my condolences to the supporter's family. He has been named by West Bromwich Albion tonight as Mark Townsend, and I do want to pass on my condolences. And we are very much a family club, and I think his death will be felt by everybody who supports West Bromwich Albion. But as with the account that you heard from Ali Jones earlier, I've had emails in, I've had direct messages sent to me, and they all tell a very similar story. So this is just one that I've had in, Stephen. Fans were singing "Stop the Game" for at least 10 minutes and were ignored. there was a call to the stewards. It was 5 minutes before the stewards responded. When the first paramedic arrived, they didn't have any equipment on them. And the accounts that I've had suggest that it was as many as 10 minutes before appropriate equipment was taken to the spot where this supporter was. I wasn't at the game. I went to the game at Sheffield Wednesday last season. I couldn't make it yesterday. But I've heard those kind of accounts from more than one source. And there is a consistency about this, Stephen, that suggests the emergency response was not adequate.
And you will understand as much as I do that clearly we should all wait and find out what the official response is from the paramedics, the emergency services that were providing care at that time, as to what was or wasn't there. But you're receiving a number of consistent accounts that will at least raise questions, Adrian, right?
Yeah, these are anecdotal accounts and I make no greater claim for them than that, but they are consistent and they are from a number of different sources. No reason to believe there's any kind of collusion with those sources. So, as I say, the accounts are consistent. And I think there is a bigger issue here, Stephen, that the safety of Hillsborough. You know, we all, or those of us of a certain age anyway, remember the tragedy there in 1989. Now, the upper tier of the Leppings Lane end, where this tragedy happened yesterday, was above where the sadly, 97 Liverpool supporters lost their lives. That stand has not changed significantly, the upper part of it, since that tragedy in 1989. And in August, The Athletic, which I think most people would acknowledge is a respected sports online magazine, said that they had contacted the supporters of 26 clubs who had visited Hillsborough in the previous seasons, and six of those had reported serious issues relating to crowd safety at the Leppings Lane end of the stadium. So I think there is a very strong argument that that ground, or at least that part of the ground, needs to be looked at. I'm very keen that there should be no witch hunts against Sheffield Wednesday and certainly not against their supporters. But I think there is a consistency, both the reports that we heard from West Bromwich Albion supporters about yesterday's incident, but also if you look back at that Athletic article, this is not sadly an isolated incident.
And so where does this go next, Adrian? Is there a hunger for information from the fans as to what happened? How can they be reassured?
Well, I think there's a need for action, isn't there? I mean, clearly we need to wait and see what any investigation into this particular incident yields. But I go to games every week, and as an away fan, I mean, I remember an incident earlier this season, Stephen, when I was in at QPR's ground, which is a fantastic old-fashioned English football ground. But at the end of the game, all of the upper deck in the away end was funneled into one exit to get out. Now, if somebody at the back of that crowd had fallen ill and needed some kind of emergency attendance, I don't know how any emergency service would have got to them. So there are issues at other grounds as well. I think one question that's been raised today is about whether there should simply be a defibrillator in every section of every stadium. That wouldn't cost a huge amount of money. You can get a defibrillator for 800 quid or less. But I do think that, thankfully, although these incidents are very, very rare, we know they do happen. And I think football as an industry needs to up its game in terms of safety and stewarding. And sadly, it seems that some of the lessons of 1989, if they were learned, have now been forgotten.
You know, I don't attend football games. There's not a defib in every ground. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there may be a defibrillator in every ground, but the architecture of grounds like Sheffield Wednesday's grounds, means that getting one to where somebody needs one at the appropriate moment may be very difficult. You know, if you've got a defibrillator, let's say where the players' tunnel is, where the managers, the coaches and the substitutes are sitting, that's not very far from the upper tier of the away section, but actually getting it's there, particularly if the stewards are not convinced there is a need for one, can be quite a time-consuming business. Now, as far as I'm aware, there is no requirement for the to be a defibrillator in every section, in every stand of a stadium, and nor is there, as far as I'm aware, any mandatory need for a medic or somebody qualified to use that defibrillator in every stand. And the accessibility of some of these stands, particularly at older grounds, is not good. But if you've got alert stewarding, and again, I'm not casting aspersions, I'm only reporting what supporters have told me. If you've got alert stewarding, that whole process can be accelerated. How well trained are the stewards? That was one of the questions, again, that was raised in the Athletic article in August, not just by West Brom fans yesterday.
Adrian, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir, for talking to us this evening. The 11 o'clock news is coming up right now.
Of the UK
and the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Simon English. President Biden has said an all-out war in the Middle East must be avoided and that he'd be speaking with his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel has expanded its operation against Iranian allies, bombing Houthi targets in Yemen. The Israeli military said the port of Hodeidah was being used to transfer Iranian weapons and oil. Lebanon's health ministry says more than 50 people have been killed in continuing airstrikes on the country. Our correspondent John Donison, who's in Jerusalem, says Israel's been showing its far-reaching power by fighting on multiple fronts.
In Lebanon, in Gaza, of course, and in Yemen, officials are saying the number of people killed is 4, with 29 injured. Now, that is some 1,800 kilometres away from Israel, so the reach of Israel's military is long. They say these strikes were in response to attacks carried out by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels there.
Rishi Sunak has urged the Conservative Party to end the backbiting and the squabbling. In a speech on the opening day of the party's conference in Birmingham, the former Prime Minister said he had one final ask for members to get behind whoever wins the contest to replace him. A man who was arrested after the death of an 8-year-old boy from gunshot wounds in Cumbria has been released on bail pending further investigations. Officers were called out to a farm yesterday afternoon. Projections in Austria show the far-right Freedom Party is heading for an unprecedented general election victory, but the FPO is expected to fall short of the outright majority it would need to govern alone. Georgios Samaras, an assistant professor of public policy at King's College London, thinks other political parties will unite against the FPO.
At the moment, we have a party that's striking parallels with AfD, the German openly neo-Nazi party, anti-migration rhetoric, and of course, heavy Islamophobia. I don't think that FPO, despite its win, will find any coalition partners, as most liberal forces are poised to come together, NEOS, FPO, and the Social Democrats, to stop the far right.
In football, Tottenham are celebrating a 3-0 win over Manchester United at Old Trafford. Elsewhere, Aston Villa drew